John Hinckley Sr., the father of the person who supposedly shot Reagan, and usually with our political assassinations, there is a diversionary figure, you know, again, some lone nut who blazes away, while the real assassins pull the trigger in expert fashion and escape out the back door. John Hinckley Jr. was a son of John Hinckley Sr., who was, first of all, a major contributor to George Bush's primary campaign when he was challenging Ronald Reagan for the 1980 Republican nomination. He also was a participant in an organization called World Vision. That's a Christian missionary organization which also has a large media ownership. World Vision has been identified by the Christian Science Monitor and In These Times magazines, among others, as having served as a CIA front in Latin America and Southeast Asia. Bear in mind that George Bush, of course, former director of Central Intelligence, one never becomes head of the CIA and simply severs one's connections. You know too much, you know where the bodies are buried, and you don't ever really leave. We should also note that John Hinckley Jr. had been a member of the National Socialist White People's Party. That was the American Nazi Party that grew directly out of the American Nazi Party, with a capital A, capital N, and capital P, of George Lincoln Rockwell. He was the ANP's Führer, which, by the way, I referred to in our last lecture, that overlapped the Minutemen to a certain extent. And bear in mind that Rockwell's Arlington, Virginia name, address, and telephone number were in the address book of Lee Harvey Oswald at the time of his arrest. That's Oswald the Marxist, right? The cover story, I love the cover story for the shooting of President Reagan. John Hinckley was in love with Jodie Foster, and he had read The Catcher in the Rye, so he decided that he could win the affections of Jodie Foster if he shot President Reagan, this supposedly inspired by The Catcher in the Rye. I don't think there is anything, just as Rome became corrupt and fell, so too the American Empire has become corrupt and is now falling before the German Empire, and bear what I said in mind. Mark my words, the 21st century, and I suspect quite a few after that, are going to be the German century. Germany has yet to have its day as the center, as the main actor on the imperial stage. France, Spain, the Great Britain, and the United States have had their empires. Russia had its empire. Germany will now have its empire, and I expect it to be the largest and most powerful and most influential empire since Rome, and perhaps will even eclipse Rome. I suspect it's going to be quite nasty, but I think it is all but inevitable at this point. If enough people perhaps were to decide to begin becoming active against fascism, it might not be inevitable, but don't hold your breath on that. But there's nothing more indicative to me of the senility of our political, intellectual culture than the cover-up of the assassination attempt on Reagan. John Hinckley, a lone nut who read The Catcher in the Rye, shoots Reagan because he wants to get down with Jodie Foster. Right. Bear in mind that he had been a member of the National Socialist White People's Party, who threw him out because they suspected he was a government agent. Okay? Interestingly enough, he had been stopped by the Secret Service, or perhaps it was the FBI, I've forgotten which, doesn't much matter. He had been at a Nashville, Tennessee airport that President Carter had been due to fly into during the presidential campaign a few months before. He had had two handguns, a pair of handcuffs, and somewhere between 40 and 60 rounds of ammunition in his possession, and he was at the airport that Carter was due to fly into. Let me tell you something. You get caught stalking the President of the United States with two guns, live ammo, you are not going to see the light of day for the rest of your bloody natural life. They are going to salt you away like a piece of old fish, and you're going to be some bad boy's boyfriend in one of our maximum security institutions. You are not. They let him go. They said, you know, hey, John, man, come on, what's this with the guns and the ammo? You don't want to shoot President Carter, do you? And he said, nah, presumably. He said, nah, I wouldn't do a thing like that. Moi? You know, so they let him go. The day after President Reagan was shot, Scott Hinckley, John Hinckley's older brother and another son of John Hinckley Sr., was scheduled to have dinner with Neil Bush, George Bush's son, to discuss a business deal. Another member of the Bush family was dating another member of the Hinckley family, and yet we're told, you know, nothing here, right? In Europe, people understand these things. When there's a major assassination or assassination attempt, look to the corridors of power. The old Latin saying, qui bono, you know, who benefits? You know, who would have benefited if Reagan had died? I suspect, and this is conjecture, but I suspect that Reagan wasn't meant to die. He was just meant to get hurt, and that a message was delivered behind the scenes saying, hey, listen, Ronnie, you know, you're a great actor, but that's all you are. You're just meant to get up there and go, well, you know, there you go again, and wobble around like those little dolls that they have in the back windows of cars, you know, with a head kind of bobble all around. You've seen those things with a little spring under there. But he was not meant to be the real power, and I suspect that George Bush was the real power behind the throne all along, and I suspect that the message was communicated in a most unequivocal fashion on the afternoon of March 30th, while America, with its head up its collective rear end, said, wow, you know, John Hinckley wanted, he read The Catcher in the Rye and wanted to get down with Jodie Foster. That's weird, man. It's also worth noting that Hinckley's defense was conducted by the Edward Bennett Williams Law Firm, one of the preeminent power law firms in Washington, D.C., and a law firm that is inextricably linked with the intelligence community, having represented Richard Helms, John Connolly, and a great many other people in the past. The Edward Bennett Williams firm is not the sort of firm that gets contracted to handle the affairs of some screwball who wants to make it with Jodie Foster. That doesn't cut it. Now, how this relates to gun control concerns James Brady, Reagan's secretary, press secretary, got shot through the head. And Brady's widow, no, not widow, but wife Sarah, has been very, very active with an organization called Handgun Control Incorporated, or HCI. Is there somebody back there to take this gentleman's money? We have a late arrival here. Well, I tell you, I don't know where the support goes. Just come up here and give it to me. You know, that's where it's going, you know. I guess we got some people lying down on the job here. But the shooting... All righty, well, that's cool. I won't argue. You trust me for the change? Out the side door, man. And I'm gonna go read The Catcher in the Rye, you know. How this relates to gun control is because Sarah Brady used the shooting of her husband, Reagan's press secretary, also by the previous press secretary, John Connolly, another one of our more stalwart citizens, as an excuse to push for gun control. I don't want to put down Sarah Brady. I'm sure she was probably quite sincere, although I wonder if she really didn't know full well who'd really shot her husband and knew damn bloody well that nobody could do anything about it. Anyway, she became very active in an organization called Handgun Control Incorporated, okay, and used the shooting of President Reagan and her husband and the wounding of others as a pretext for taking guns away from the citizens. Now, Handgun Control Incorporated is one of the two largest handgun control organizations in the United States. Interestingly enough, that organization and its supposedly competing sister organization, one of them was founded, and I believe that was HCI was actually founded, and the other supposedly competing organization, to a large extent founded by the very same newly retired, quote, ex-unquote CIA agent, a guy named William O. Wells, W-E-L-L-E-S, who had retired, quote-unquote, from the Central Intelligence Agency in the spring of 1974 as the Watergate crisis was coming to a head. Many people felt that Nixon might try to invoke martial law as in order to head off his impending political demise. And a lot of people suspect that perhaps William O. Wells took a sudden interest in reducing people's access to firearms in anticipation of that possibility. There is a tactic in the intelligence community called sheep dipping. If an overt operative is going to be used undercover with civilian cover, just as a wolf is given sheep's clothing in order to infiltrate the flock, so too the operative undergoes sheep dipping. That's what it refers to. Wells' passion for controlling people's access to handguns is quite interesting because he himself not only owned two handguns, but a Sharps Borsart rifle. He was the founder of one and one of the main generating founders of the other supposedly competing handgun control organizations, including HCI, and I believe that's the one he founded. And again, he formally founded one and was the de facto co-founder of the other supposedly competing organization. Interestingly enough, he has been greatly assisted in his gun control efforts by none other than William Colby, the late William Colby, former director of Central Intelligence, who claimed that he learned about the dangers of handguns while working for the CIA, a statement I take at face value. Former head of the Phoenix program in Vietnam, in which scores of thousands of Vietnamese were done to death, many of them with silenced 22 and 25 caliber handguns. And again, when you become director of the CIA, you don't ever leave. You know, two or too many of the bodies are buried. And again, William O. Wells was assisted in his gun control efforts by none other than William Colby, former director of the CIA. Now, how many people would like to take a break at this point? I think this might be a decent point to take a break because it's sort of a natural cadence point in the... You want to keep going? Most people want to do that? Okay, well, then I'm moving more quickly than usual. Now, as we are going to see, the use of apparent lone nuts, again, the lone nuts that have been used to commit our allegedly commit our assassinations and attempted assassinations as justifications for gun control, has been followed by a number of seemingly random acts of mass murder by apparent lone nuts whose actions have once again been the pretext for gun control, just as Oswald Saran, James Earl Ray, and John Hinckley, that suitor of Jodie Foster, have been used as the pretext for limiting people's access to firearms. And again, our major political assassinations were the main rationalization for the U.S. Gun Control Act of 1968, patterned on the Nazi Gun Control Act of 1938, 30 years previous to that, to a considerable extent. So, too, the actions of these lone nuts, some of whose actions I'm going to go into in just a second, have been used as the justifications for gun control. Now, I'm not saying that some of these screwballs who go off and begin blazing away in a murderous fashion at strangers might not be just that. God knows America has no shortage of lunatics. We have at least as many lunatics as we do guns in this country, and there are about 230 million firearms, so that leaves probably 230 million wackos. However, some of the most bloody and some of the most influential of these lone nuts who've begun slaughtering people have, I will suggest the possibility that they may have been mind control jobs. Now, in previous lectures, I have gone into the U.S. national security establishment's mind control techniques. There are a number of different techniques that have been used to affect mind control, psychosurgery, psychopharmacology, hypnosis, operant and classical conditioning, and all of those things in various combinations with one another have been used to produce a number of effects, including the generation of lone nut assassins, someone who would commit an assassination against his or her will, and then, if need be, not remember that they had committed that assassination, or if need be, they would then be used to kill themselves. They would commit suicide. Bear in mind, the mind control techniques, very effectively developed by our intelligence community and military. I've lectured about them in the past, and in fact, there's a lecture about mind control available from She Who Remembers, just as there are archive shows about mind control available from Archives on Audio. I also want to cite a propaganda and intelligence technique that was crafted by the Third Reich and which appears to have influenced our own media and intelligence system. One of the most influential early advisors to Adolf Hitler, an individual who eventually broke with Hitler, was a German-American named Ernst Putzi Hamstengel. The name Putzi, P-U-T-Z-I, is a German affectionate nickname. It means little fellow. It was applied to Hamstengel sarcastically because he was 6'6", obviously not a little fellow. Hamstengel was, again, a German-American and indicative of the transatlantic German-American financial and industrial axis that I have spoken about as being so influential with the in the genesis of fascism. Hamstengel is given credit by many of the chroniclers of the Third Reich for developing an espionage and a propaganda technique which involved the synthesis of propaganda, covert action, and journalism. The idea was to use covert action to set up an incident which, in its external circumstances, would serve to reinforce and exemplify the propaganda being generated by the party, by Josef Goebbels' propaganda ministry, and by the NSDAP, and by Nazi Germany. The idea was you set up an incident, in one primary example, the assassination of a German diplomat in Paris by a Jew, which was then used as the rationalization by the Nazi party for the Kristallnacht, the first large-scale pogrom against the Jews in 1938, followed 2 days later by the passing of the Nazi Weapons Act of 38. The idea was, again, you use a covert operation. You set up an incident which, in its external circumstances, appears to reinforce or to exemplify your propaganda. You then have your media bandy this about to the heavens, saying, see, look at what happened here. This is just what the Nazis say. This is what the party says. Just what the CIA says. Just what the Pentagon says. Just what Senator so-and-so, Senator Dodd, perhaps, says. Again, this is a technique crafted by Ernst Putzi Hamstengel. Hamstengel is an interesting fellow, by the way. He was a member of an old and very prestigious New England family called the Sedgwicks. probably the best known member of the Sedgwick family prior to Hampstengel, who, by the way, after breaking with Hitler, wrote a book called Unheard Witness, or perhaps Unseen Witness. I believe it's Unheard Witness. I'd have to double check that. Hampstengel's American progenitor, General Sedgwick, had been a general during the American Civil War. He has what are perhaps the most ironic, famous last words of all time. He was commanding the Union forces at the Battle of Sharpsville near the end of the war, and the Confederate snipers were right on target and taking a deadly toll of Sedgwick's frontline troops. He was touring the front lines, and his aides told him, you know, don't stick your head up above the parapets. You know, the Confederate snipers are absolutely deadly. They've been picking off our men all day. He said, nonsense. They couldn't hit an elephant at this dist. As he poked his head up above the parapets, he caught a bullet right between the eyes and never finished the word distance. Hampstengel was on his mother's side, I believe it was, a member of the Sedgwick family. He was educated, by the way, at Harvard University. And he is the individual that is most often given credit by chroniclers of the Third Reich for having crafted the Sieg Heil cheer that was evident at the Nazi rallies. And Hampstengel, in his biography, claims that the inspiration for the Sieg Heil cheer, which he deemed to be necessary to have an in-unison, throaty cheer to wow the crowds, he said his inspiration for that was the Harvard University football cheers that he heard as an undergraduate at Harvard University. So bear that one in mind. But Hampstengel was the individual who crafted the Third Reich propaganda and espionage technique, again, a synthesis of journalism, propaganda, and covert operations, which I believe has been utilized by our own intelligence system today. Indeed, people like Fred Landis, whose work I'm going to touch on in a minute, have developed a number of indications that this is in fact the case, that we use journalism, covert operations, and propaganda in combination with one another, borrowing the technique directly from the Third Reich. Perhaps it's sort of an example of what goes around, comes around, because the Third Reich got it from a good German-American Harvard graduate, Ernst Pupsi Hampstengel, according to most biographers. One of the lone nuts about which I have a great many questions, and I suspect an individual who may have been a mind control job, and certainly whose act was the impetus for the banning of assault weapons, legislation which is introduced banning assault weapons, and that certainly was one of the things which began to not only get the ball rolling with regard to gun control, but which also began to stimulate political reaction. People began, the conservatives and explicitly fascist elements began saying, see, the guns are getting taken away, we have to do something. In January of 1989, Patrick Edward Purdy, an apparent lone nut, walked onto the grounds of a Stockton, California elementary school and began blazing away at school children, most of whom, by the way, were of Asian American extraction, killed, I think, five children, greatly, badly wounded a great many others, then put the gun to his head and blew himself away. This was the impetus for the passing of legislation by not only our state legislature but others, banning so-called assault weapons, which up to that time had never killed a law enforcement officer, which was the ostensible rationalization. I would also note that Purdy appears to have been deeply prejudiced against Asian Americans. He has some overt fascist and possible national security connections that we're going to talk about in a second. But he was known to have expressed the view that Asian Americans were taking over the country, that there was no more place for white people, a frequent theme in white supremacist literature and white supremacist complaints. Patrick Edward Purdy had been arrested previously for a number of different times. By the way, more than 42 different law enforcement agencies around the United States had files on Patrick Edward Purdy. We should also note that Purdy, at the time of a previous arrest, had Aryan Nations literature in his possession. So he had had some contact with the milieu of the Aryan Nations. He also was known to have worked as a collector of monies, a peddler, for the Moon Organization in the past. That's the organization of Reverend Sun Myung Moon. Now, that is a mind control and intelligence cult that uses mind control and whose genesis, and I've spoken about mind control and the Moon Organization in the past, goes directly back to the forces of Japanese fascism. And in fact, I have developed the working hypothesis that the Moon Organization is a direct projection through the years and across the Atlantic, and or the Pacific rather, and around the world, of the Japanese patriotic or ultra-nationalist societies. Fascism came to Japan largely as a result of a series of political assassinations and terrorist acts that were conducted by the so-called patriotic or ultra-nationalist societies. These organizations can be thought of as a combination between intelligence fronts, organized crime syndicates, and religious cults. They were run by the Imperial Japanese General Staff and its officer corps, and they committed a series of political assassinations and terrorist acts in combination with various young cadets and officers that eliminated the legitimate political leadership of Japan and paved the way for the rise of fascism in Japan. And indeed, many of the key early operatives for the Moon Organization had been Japanese fascists. Two of the most important were Roichi Sasakawa, and also a fellow named Yoshio Kodama. Roichi Sasakawa, the self-proclaimed world's richest fascist, unquote, was one of the prime movers of the Asian People's Anti-Communist League, very active in the former World Anti-Communist League, about which I've spoken already this evening. Again, Thomas Dodd was very active with ASC and very close to elements involved with WACL, including the anti-Bolshevik Bloc of Nations. Roichi Sasakawa had been an ardent Japanese fascist, very close to Admiral Yamamoto, who led the fleet that attacked Pearl Harbor. And he also had been interned by the United States in Sugamo Prison at the end of World War II as a war criminal. However, just as we did in Germany and Italy, so too in Japan, we used many of our former fascist, quote, enemies, unquote, because the Japanese also received a lot of assistance from our corporations, and we put them right back in power to use against the communists. Again, some of my musings early on about that, who's the real war criminal, you know, Eric Priebke, or all the people that have winked at fascism and aided it behind the scenes, supposedly righteous. That's a thought to think about. Another key early Moon operative was Yoshio Kodama. Yoshio Kodama was known in Japanese society and the post-World War II society as a kurumaku, and I'm not sure about the pronunciation. It's a term that comes from kabuki theater. It means the man behind a black curtain who operates the little puppets that appear in front before the audience. Kodama had been deeply active with the Japanese patriotic or ultra-nationalist societies. The day Pearl Harbor was attacked, he set up the Kodama Fund, which was used to smuggle contraband, drugs, jewels, all kinds of things, black market currency, in order to fund the Japanese Imperial Naval Air Arm, which obviously had that very day attacked Pearl Harbor. Later, Kodama was involved in a payoff scandal in Japan in which Japanese politicians were known to have taken payoffs from the Lockheed Corporation in order to arm the Japanese self-defense forces with Lockheed combat aircraft. By the way, one of his co-defendants in that scandal was General Minoru Genda, who had previously been given a medal by the United States Air Force for his role in helping Lockheed move its aircraft abroad. One of the most ironic things in the world, again, not only the fact that he was given a medal by the U.S. Air Force for taking bribes in order to get the Japanese to buy Lockheed aircraft for their Air Force, but it was General Minoru Genda who actually crafted the actual plan for the air armada that attacked Pearl Harbor, and he led the aerial attack forces that devastated Pearl Harbor, which just goes to show you how screwed up things can be. But Patrick Edward Purdy, going back to that, had been an operative of the Moon Organization. He was traveling all around the United States with no visible means of support. Over 42 different law enforcement organizations had files on him, and he supposedly had been supporting himself by stealing waiters and waitresses' tips off of their tables at restaurants. Try traveling around the United States supporting yourself doing that. First of all, you're very likely to get a steak knife and your expletive deleted if you try that. As someone who has waited on tables, let me tell you something. Servers, as they're now called, keep a real close eye on their tips. And you don't want to go around trying to steal them, because like I say, you're probably going to wind up with a steak knife and a tender part of your anatomy if you try it. Supposedly, however, Patrick Edward Purdy was able to pull this off. We know that he had some kind of contact with Aryan nations in the past. He had their literature in his possession at the time of a previous arrest. We should also note, again, that Patrick Edward Purdy had been working for the Moon Organization, which practices mind control and is inextricably linked with not only the Korean Central Intelligence Agency, but our own right wing, our own intelligence services, and also the World Anti-Communist League that we also discussed in connection with the political resume of Thomas Dodd. We should note, again, that as soon as Patrick Edward Purdy blazed away at these children in the Stockton schoolyard, all of a sudden calls went out to ban assault weapons. This is one of the indications to me that the Hamstengel Third Reich synthesis of espionage, propaganda, and covert operations may have been in effect here. and that Patrick Edward Purdy, like Lee Harvey Oswald, John Hinckley, and so many others, may have been in a fascist U.S. intelligence patsy, being trafficked around and mind controlled so that he'd all of a sudden just go bokomatic and start blazing away at these kids, and he then puts a gun to his head and blows his own brains out very conveniently so he's not available for questioning after that. Like some other people we're going to take a look at in a minute. This immediately spurred calls for gun control legislation, and people were righteously beating their breasts saying, we have to take these assault weapons out of the hands of the citizens because it represents a danger to law enforcement. There's no cop had ever been killed by an assault weapon. I would also note that I think it's one of the indications to me that the Hohmstengel technique may have been in effect here. If Patrick Edward Purdy had driven onto the schoolyard, Stockton Schoolyard elementary grounds with a pickup truck and run those kids over, I don't think you would have been seeing legislation introduced by self-righteous legislators advocating that Americans had their access to motor vehicles limited. I seriously doubt it. I would also note that a teacher from that Stockton school that who was going to testify before the legislature had received a threatening letter with a swastika letterhead. Again, bear in mind my musing at the beginning of the lecture that gun control may very well be being used to polarize the American population, and I'm going to use a couple of words I used in my militia lecture, polarization, stratification. I used those in my last lecture in order to polarize people, drive people into the arms of the far right, and we know, obviously, that the right wing of the Republican Party, Newt Gingrich, the right wing of the Republican Party. What the hell other wing of the Republican Party is there? Newt Gingrich, Bob Dole, and others have made a lot of political hay about defending the Second Amendment. One of the very few things I agree with Newt Gingrich and Bob Dole about. We should note this in the context. This is something of an historic occasion under the circumstances. By the way, I also want to point out something utterly ludicrous that I touched on last time. This is a slight digression. But where Pat Buchanan, you know, old macho Pat, you know, the darling of the right wing, who's made a lot of political hay by defending firearms rights, he's out in front of a bunch of good old boys in Arizona, and he holds up a Winchester rifle and says, these aren't just for hunting ducks, you know, and there's a throaty roar, yay, right on, Pat, you know, right here, we know. Of course, wink, wink, we're going to use these to blow away, you know, ATF, jackbooted thugs or somebody else. Pat Buchanan, along with his brothers, by the way, comes from an old Washington, D.C. family. They were noted as young men for beating people up. They were notorious bullies, always getting arrested. Youthful offenders, though, you know, they're not going to be... They never stood trial as adults, right? But they were basically old-line Washington, D.C., white-collar panty waists. And an indication of that, here he's holding up a Winchester rifle and say, these are just for duck hunting, you know, and you know, right on, baby. You don't use a Winchester rifle for hunting ducks. You hunt ducks with a shotgun, and anybody with half a brain and know anything about guns knows that. But just that was a superbly, deliciously ironic moment in the history of American reactionary politics that escaped a lot of people. These aren't just for hunting ducks, because obviously, in holding up a Winchester rifle, Pat Buchanan was indicating to anybody with any kind of smarts just what kind of a beltway, Washington, inside, white-collar panty waist he really was. This guy doesn't know duck hunting from fishing. And it's just very, very funny to me that here he's the candidate of the good old boys talking about hunting ducks with a Winchester rifle. Man, you'd have to be one hell of a marksman to bring down a duck on the wing with a Winchester rifle. You could perform that kind of marksmanship. You belong in the Texas School Book Depository, man. You're some kind of a shot, you know? But again, going back to Patrick Edward Purdy, if he'd driven a pickup truck onto the grounds of that Stockton schoolyard and run over those kids with a pickup truck, do you think legislators would have been advocating that people have their access to motor vehicles denied? Not bloody like it. But all of a sudden, we're seeing this legislation. We've got to deny people access to firearms. We've got to deny people access to guns. Get rid of these terrible assault weapons. I would also note that I think it's altogether possible that in addition to spurring the call for firearms legislation, the Purdy incident may also have been a domestic application of a fascist political strategy called the strategy of tension, in which terrorist incidents are precipitated in order to kill innocent victims whose relatives and sympathizers in the body politic would then spur calls for legislation to be passed to restrict civil liberties, increase police and surveillance powers in order to combat this heinous menace. If you want to terrorize the squat out of the baby boom generation, just start threatening their kids. The baby boomers and their little kids are the largest population groups in the United States. You want to win their hearts and minds for a program of political reaction? Just send some lone nut, moony, former Aryan Nations fellow traveler out with an assault rifle to start shooting at, you know, little Timothy or little Susie or whoever. And by God, you watch all those little baby boomers, some of whom might be real liberal, they're going to go jumping into the arms of political reaction saying, yep, we need broader police powers, broader surveillance powers, more prisons, tougher laws, tougher judges, because I don't want little Timothy getting shot at while he's on his way to preschool computer class. You know, he's a precious little boy because he's my little boy. And anyway, I wonder to what extent that may have been an act of terrorism, and a very effective one at that, in order to justify on people's minds broader police and surveillance powers, reduced civil liberties, tougher laws, tougher judges, more prisons in order to combat this rash of lone nuts. Also, I want to note, and this may not be significant in any respect, I want to note that the spokesperson who had handled all of the PR work for that particular Stockton Schoolyard district had been the chief, prior to retiring from the U.S. Army and going to work for that school district, had been the chief spokesperson for the United States Army's Western States Command, okay? He then left the United States Army and went to work in exactly that same capacity for the Stockton Schoolyard district. And again, there may be no significance of that. That may be a coincidence. But on the other hand, I wonder about the possibility of him as some sort of sheep-dipped military intelligence operative operating in that same capacity. Because if indeed, and I'm afraid this is going to happen, martial law is declared at some point in response to civil unrest following an economic collapse and resulting political catastrophe, some sort of natural disaster or terrorist incident, say, the International Islamic Peace and Violence Group or some other group of agent provocateur lights up a nuclear power plant or something else delightful or spreads around chemical or biological weapons, and martial law is declared, and all of a sudden all those people who were so hot to trot to get assault weapons out of people's hands are taking a look around while a bunch of skinheads or a Nazi militia elements are knocking at their front doors looking to arrest them or take them out on the day of the rope and hang them from the nearest lamppost. They may take a look and wish they, by God, had an AK on hand, or at very least a .22 or something other than a kitchen knife and a line of bull, because that ain't going to get you too far under those circumstances. But again, I wonder about the spokesperson for the Stockton School District, previously the spokesperson for the United States Army Western Command. I can continue with some of these lone nuts. I wonder, now, are people, how y'all figured, you want to take a break at this point?
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to take a break. I don't know if we've got our recorders back there. Nope, we got nobody on hand. Nobody home here, folks. So let's turn off the cassette deck, and we're going to take a break for... Now, we've been discussing some of the apparent lone nuts who have been blazing away at complete strangers for no apparent reason, and then these heinous acts are then followed by calls for gun control legislation. I have been suggesting the possibility, and again, I want to emphasize that this is a speculative element, that some of these lone nuts may actually be mind-controlled jobs programmed to do what they are doing for a couple of reasons, maybe even more than a couple. One, to terrorize the living expletive deleted out of people into accepting broader police and surveillance powers, reduced civil liberties, more laws, tougher judges, more jails, and less freedom. Also, I'm suggesting the possibility that some of these lone nuts may be being employed along the lines of the Hamstengel Third Reich synthesis technique of combining covert action, journalism, and propaganda in order to use covert action to set up an incident which would be reported by the journalistic community in such a way as to reinforce government propaganda. We've been talking about Patrick Edward Purdy and his, there's an archive show about that, by the way, available from archives on audio, that I called Purdy's Last Stand, about the Stockton Schoolyard Massacre. And we should note that this incident, which suggests at least the possibility of Purdy being a mind-controlled intelligence patsy, we should also note in this regard that the Aryan Nations themselves, or white supremacist groups themselves, have been developing mind-control techniques. So it's possible that he could have been a mind-control job of some sort of white supremacist group rather than just the government. Again, note that he'd worked for the Moonies, which is a government-connected fascist intelligence mind-control front. So there's certainly reason to suspect this. I also have questions about a number of other of these lone nuts have been blazing away at people. And one of those is a guy named George Kennard. Actually, perhaps his name was Kennard. This was a fellow who went off for seemingly no reason and began, you just bring that up here, who began blazing away at a bunch of complete strangers in Killeen, Texas, which, by the way, is right outside of the largest U.S. Army base in the continental United States, which is Fort Hood. This fellow went off and committed what, at least at that time, perhaps to say his record's been broken, was the largest massacre by a single gunman in American history. It occurred on the very same day that there was a crime bill before Congress to be voted on in Congress, which contained some of the strictest gun control provisions to date. Kennard went off and began blazing away at these complete strangers, killed, I think, 20-some-odd people. It was a horrendous massacre, and he then was killed subsequently by police. This massacre occurred, again, the same day that a crime bill was, you can bring that up here, was in front of Congress to be voted on by Congress. And in the newspapers the next day, virtually every major daily, or at least the ones that I took, juxtaposed the reportage concerning the crime bill with the reportage concerning Kennard's going off and blazing away at these people. That type of juxtaposition. Now, certainly, I'm sure the thought would have occurred to X number of page editors to juxtapose these two stories as a natural process. Fred Landis, as well as a marvelous LA-based researcher named Donald Freed, have done a lot of work on the U.S. intelligence community's use of media as a component of covert operations. One of the things that our intelligence community does is to juxtapose stories which don't necessarily have any connection with one another in order to create a psychological association between the two. Landis and also, to a certain extent, Donald Freed have done work on the use of, for example, the Daily Gleaner in Jamaica to destabilize Prime Minister Michael Manley. They've done work on the use of La Prensa in Nicaragua to destabilize the Sandinistas, as well as the use of El Mercurio in Chile to destabilize the Allende regime. One of the things that they do is to juxtapose two stories, like, say, a story about Daniel Ortega, the former president of Nicaragua, with a story about some horrible massacre or some horrible disease, or even a photograph of a mutilated cow or dead cows. The idea is to create a psychological association under optimum conditions, an unconscious psychological association between, say, Daniel Ortega and images of death, sickness, disease, famine, economic ruin. The idea to get people to associate the thought of ruinous things with Daniel Ortega. I would note, by the way, we're talking about lone nuts, the fellow who went off in San Diego in the summer of 1984 and began blazing away at a bunch of kids at McDonald's. There was this happened the day that Walter Mondale got the Democratic nomination, and it showed, you know, gunman massacres, 19 people at McDonald's, and it showed a picture of Walter Mondale smiling there. And I wondered to what extent that was to get people to identify unconsciously Walter Mondale with massacres and a totally out of control society. The juxtaposition by the media of Mr. Kennard's massacre and the reportage of this crime bill, which again contains some of the most stringent gun control legislation to date, is characteristic of the type of media component to a covert operation. There was also discussion of Kennard's having been visited by a mysterious blonde woman who nobody seemed to know who she was. If Kennard was a mind control job, she might perhaps have been his control. He previously served in the Navy, which doesn't necessarily mean anything. However, in the lecture that I did about mind control, as well as in some of the archive shows that I produced, the use of so-called passive-aggressive personalities by naval intelligence as candidates for mind control in order to create assassins is something that is well documented. Kennard appears to have been a passive-aggressive personality. Again, I wonder whether perhaps he was a mind control job and programmed to commit his massacre in order to reinforce sentiment for gun control legislation. Again, this is not a statement I'm making, but a question I'm asking. And I want to stress with these lone nuts have been blazing away at people, this is a speculative element. Another question I have, another one of these lone nut massacres, concerns the massacre at the 101 California Street office building in San Francisco. A fellow named Johnny Ferri, a native of Italy, a naturalized American citizen, who in addition to his native Italian and English also spoke fluent Arabic, by the way, something that most Americans do not do, once again walked into a building and began massacring a bunch of complete strangers. He had apparently had some legal work done by some of the people in that building and was supposedly dissatisfied about this. Many of the relatives of the victims and also some of the victims who had been less than fatally wounded were called to testify before Congress about the horrors of this experience, as well as before the state legislature here in California. And their testimony helped once again to reinforce sentiment for gun control legislation. There are a number of interesting things about Ferri. Again, he spoke fluent Arabic in addition to his native Italian and English. That doesn't necessarily mean anything, but he also was operating in Nevada and Southern California, moving large amounts of money through some corporations that he handled, but none of that money was his. Now, again, that doesn't necessarily mean anything, but it is, those types of things are characteristic of people who are handling money laundering operations for the intelligence community and or organized crime. And again, with a fluent knowledge of Arabic, trafficking around large amounts of money through corporate fronts in Nevada and Southern California, none of which was his. He was apparently destitute. It would lead a trained observer of intelligence operations to ask the question, just like Kevin Costner's portrayal of Jim Garrison in the movie JFK. Ask the question. Very important thing to do. Ferri also had made a videotape of himself posed with his various assault weapons, showing the time and the laying down of a track for an intelligence patsy in order to then surface this record later so that it would be bandied about by the media, is also characteristic of intelligence operations. Now, again, this does not mean that Johnny Ferri was some sort of intelligence patsy, but I raise the question. Again, like Kevin Costner portraying Jim Garrison, ask the question. I would also note that there was a curious delay in the police response at 101 California Street. There was an unconscionable delay in their response to the 911 call. Again, I wonder whether perhaps they were on notice that they should wait and let this happen. I'm not saying this is the case, but I'm asking the question, is it? And I think it's a possibility that should be seriously considered. Once again, Johnny Ferri and the victims of his massacre were used as congressional witnesses to spur sympathy for gun control legislation. I would also note that one of the law firms that was heavily victimized in that massacre had been doing work for the Resolution Trust Corporation, helping to settle the assets of failed savings and loans. There is a very distinct connection between organized crime and the intelligence community and the savings and loans scandal. Now, again, none of these details necessarily proves anything. However, taken in conjunction with one another, they suggest the possibility, at least, of Ferri as a possible mind control job and of his massacre as a possible domestic application of the strategy of tension. One of the things the national security establishment does is when they are going to do something, they only launch an operation when it will scratch a number of different itches at different levels simultaneously. In addition to terrorizing the you-know-what out of people, spurring again sympathy for broader police state tactics, increased surveillance powers, reduced civil liberties, tougher laws and judges, more jails, etc., perhaps even ultimately martial law. It may be that some troublesome lawyers who were perhaps asking too many questions about some of the savings and loans, whose assets they were helping to resolve, were eliminated in this massacre. If he was a mind control job, it's possible that that happened. I'm not saying that that necessarily happened. Now, one of the things that's so curious about the sudden cries for gun control that we're seeing, in particular in response to some of these highly visible massacres by lone nuts who are going off for no apparent reason and blazing away at complete strangers, is the fact that guns don't cause crime. If you have a criminal, they can certainly use a gun in a crime, but there is no relationship directly between between murder and the presence of firearms in a society. The most heavily armed society per capita in this world is Switzerland. All Swiss males between the ages of 18 and I believe it's 50, maybe even 60, have to serve in the Swiss Army Reserves.